Right, come on, let's see what you've got. Off the chair, let's go.
Papa loves mambo, mama loves mambo. Look at him sway with it.
Ooh, like it.
With it. Shout no lay with it. Wow. Papa loves mambo.
Papa loves mambo.
Mama loves
mambo. All right, all right. That's enough of that. Okay. Hello. welcome to another catch-up episode. How are you? Ooh, okay. Well, good. I'm hoping you said you were good, but it's all right if you said you weren't. Because everything's all right, isn't it? It's all right to allow all those feelings, the different feelings that we all have in these strange and uncertain times. Or, you know, as I like to think of it, the times were always uncertain, but now we're just much more aware of it. Okay, well, if I sound a bit croaky, it's because yesterday I recorded three podcasts, pretty much one after the other, with three emerging artists. And I kind of screwed up a bit because when I thought, I mean, it's kind of been in my mind to have emerging artists, and the feedback from your good self has been, yes. That's a lovely idea. Can we do that? Can you have a few more emerging artists on? That'd be very interesting to hear about how they are, you know, when they're starting out and on their journey. So the last few times I've had artists who are younger, it kind of went quickly because, they didn't have a huge amount to say compared to, you know, the sort of Vincent Desiderio, Bo Bartlett, Nicholas Uribe, you know, the marathons, you know, compared to those, they relatively didn't have had a lot to say. So I kind of thought, I'll have the three artists on and, you know, it'll be, each one will be somewhere between half an hour and maybe 45 minutes. And then I'll put them all together and it'll make a nice little show, right? The thing I'd forgotten, though, was that since I've been doing these uncut ones, I've been using questions from yourself a lot more. So I just kind of went into automatic mode and kind of went, okay, so you ask for questions from your fans and followers and I'll do the same and we'll see how we go. And of course, as soon as the questions came in, I'd already booked them in, right? I'd already booked them in for yesterday. I had chatted with Tom at 10, Tom McLean. I had Kasia in for, I think it was 1 o'clock, and then I had Jesse Lane in for 3. Looked great on paper. But then the questions started to come in, and then it dawned on me, these are not going to be short. These are all going to be long. They turned out to be that. So it's like I ended up with three pretty much full episodes. So by the end of it, I was a bit croaky. So that's what that's about. The last three podcasts that since we last caught up, they've been great. I had that lovely chat with Julian Davis, who I'd been wanting to chat with for ages. And then I had a great chat with Hollis Dunlap. That got a bit controversial. It was kind of unexpected for me. but then not surprising considering everything that's going on. But yeah, I think it's about 2.5 hours in, there was a question. It was a kind of a purity test question for Hollis, and he voiced his response to it, and I did the same, and we moved on and got back to talking about painting. But I was surprised with some of the things that people said afterwards. You know, it was pretty much half and half. I thought he came across quite well balanced, but some people just thought he was a complete racist and said that to me. Got in touch with me afterwards, which was kind of sad because I didn't get that. Now, that could be a failing on my part. I might have missed it, but yeah, I don't think I'm naive, and I don't think I'm you know, I miss things. So he didn't come across like that to me at all. So yeah, it was kind of sad that people, you know, sort of felt like that. To me, he just seemed to be expressing his opinion, and he doesn't like being pushed around. Now, maybe I don't know all the facts about what's going on. I am in Ireland, and he's talking about a situation in America. But yeah, so that was, well, different. Yeah, different. And then, yeah, great chat with Mitch Griffiths, who I started off thinking, you know, he was going to be the first person I talked to who actually had COVID, but it turned out he didn't. So I'm not, I sound like I'm disappointed. I was not disappointed at all. But yeah, it was, I kind of thought he was going to, you know, tell me how it was to be on the inside of COVID. But no, he didn't have it. He had, well, if you, you know, if you've heard it, he had health issues that looked like COVID, and he was told it was COVID, but then turned out not to be COVID. But yeah, Mitch is great and fantastic as always. I've been doing a bit of cycling lately, which is a lovely return for me, because when we moved down to Kerry, I had been doing a bit of cycling in Dublin, but when we moved down here, the roads are very narrow and the drivers are all crazy for such a peaceful, beautiful place. I don't know why everybody's in such a hurry. You know, like, people speed past me, overtaking me on these tiny roads. I'm like, where are you going? Where could you possibly be going? You know, in Dublin, I'd understand. It's like, you know, everyone has this feeling of importance and busyness, and I've got really important things to do, and I'm a very busy, important person, and that's fine. But down here, it's like, where could you be going? Like, where could you be going at such a hurry? Anyway, it made cycling a bit terrifying, because the cars go pretty close to you as a cyclist. But anyway, just my body, you know, I spent a lot of time meditating, as you know, and my body was just going, now you're going to have to move some more. Playing golf, you know, once or twice a week is basically like going for a very slow 4-hour walk, which is nice and everything, and it's better than not doing anything. But no, we need to get the heart rate up a little bit more, please. Can you organize that? So anyway, just something changed in me, and I was like, right, I'm going to start cycling again. Which is lovely, because cycling has always been in my life, you know. Like, I wouldn't say I had a fantastic childhood, but I had a pretty idyllic adolescence because I joined, they're called the Venture Scouts here. It's part of the Scout, you know, Boy Scout movement thing. But it was mixed. It was, you know, boys and girls. And it was, Venture Scouts are like for teenagers. So I spent my teenage years hiking and camping and canoeing and rock climbing and cycling and doing all sorts of outdoor thing, which for, you know, a kid who was, you know, brought up in the suburbs and the pretty, pretty bleak suburbs, to get out into nature was just amazing for me. No experience of it at all. And you know, like, I know people like who grew up around the same time as me, and, you know, they'd be talking about drugs and all this kind of stuff, and I'd no experience of any of that kind of thing. You know, I was off with my friends camping and having campfires and sing songs, and, you know, it's amazing, really, and I'm so grateful for it. So yeah, like, early on in that, cycling was one of the things we were really into, and it was in the era of when Ireland was doing pretty well in professional cycling. It was in this sort of Sean Kelly and Stephen Roach who were like winning the Tour de France or winning the Giro d'Italia, and, you know, so it's a kind of at the time, it felt like a golden age in cycling. I mean, since Lance Armstrong kind of ruined that for everybody, now it doesn't look so golden. But back then it was. And one of the chaps in the Scouts, Venture Scouts, his uncle owned a bicycle store, so we were all mad into it, right? And we went on a cycling tour of France, and in the run up to it, I was saving my pennies, and bit by bit, I was buying this bike. It was a Mercian, right? So I bought it piece by piece because that's, you know, like I don't, you know, when you're in a gang of people, gang of guys and gals who are into something, you know, you just sort of do what everyone else is doing. And what everyone else was doing was building their bikes. They weren't just buying them off the shelf. So I remember having like all the, you know, pieces for the bike. I had the frame laid out on in my bedroom, you know, and I'd buy the brakes, and then the next week I'd buy, you know, the chain wheel and so on. So bit by bit, you know, it's a bit like that Johnny Cash song about that guy building the car, which I can't remember. Let me see if I can find it.
I'd get it one piece at a time, and it wouldn't cost me a dime. You'll know it's me when I come through your town. I'm gonna ride around in style, I'm gonna drive everybody wild, 'cause I'll have the only one there is around.
Yeah, something like that. And unfortunately, I ran out of money just before we went to France. So somebody lent me a bike. Kevin, the guy who his uncle owned the shop, he lent me a bike. But when we got back from France, I think we spent 2 weeks cycling around northern France. Fantastic, like. I think I was 15 or 16 at the time. You know, amazing, amazing thing. Anyway, so I come back and I built the bike. Anyway, that was beautiful. I had my beautiful Mercian. Everything was handpicked and put together. I mean, I'm trying to convey how much love and attention I put into this bike, right? And then every time we went cycling, because we'd go away for the weekend cycling as well, and then the next weekend we'd be going camping, and the next weekend we'd be going canoeing or something like that. Anyway, so life moved on. I moved into my 20s. This is going somewhere, by the way. life moved on. I got into my 20s and all the kind of complications of that. And, you know, Venture Scouts kind of ends around then anyway. And, you know, I sort of drifted away from that group of people and from cycling. And I, before that happened, it was probably around 20, 21, 22, something like that. One of the guys in that group, because I'd, you know, the decline or the drifting away from that group was mirrored in my bike. So my bike slowly kind of wasn't the focus of my attention anymore, and I wasn't taking care of it as well as I had in the past, and it was looking a bit rough. Anyway, a friend of mine from that group, Niall, said, you know, you're not using your bike anymore. Would you sell it to me? So the idea of a bit of cash sounded a lot better to me than the bike. So I said, yeah, that's fine. So I sold him the bike. So fast forward about, how many years would it be? About 25 years, 30 years, something like that. A good bit of time. And my wife and I were in Tuscany on a business thing for my wife's business. And on the way back, on the plane back to Ireland, in the in-flight magazine, I saw this article about a vintage bicycle race that's held every year in Tuscany, in a little town called Chianti in Giole. And had these great pictures of the race. And the idea of the race was started to try and preserve the white gravel roads that they have there. These roads were sort of systematically being modernized, which means tarmacadamed. So a lot of the very early kind of cycling in Italy, cycling races, were done on these white gravel roads. They're called Strada Bianca. And so this race was kind of set up to try and preserve just a bit of the heritage of that. And so the criteria is that all the bikes in the race have to be older than 1987, I think it is. Anything more modern than that, you can't use it. So it's like old bikes. So it's 1987 or older, right? And they get into the spirit of it. They dress up in the older kind of gear, the woolen jerseys, and depending on what age their bike is, they'll try and dress to match it. And at the pit stops for the race, Instead of, you know, power drinks and power bars and energy this and whatever, it's the way that the pit stops used to be in the old races. So it's like wine and ham and cheese and bread and grapes and that kind of thing. Okay, so I just found it delightful. So I was saying, it sort of ignited something in me. And I was saying to my wife, I'd love to do that. Let's do that. And so the following year, we went back with some family members and we did it. Four of us did it. There's four different routes of varying length. So we did the shortest one. I think that was 37 kilometers. I'm not sure what that is in miles. What would that be? I don't know, 30 miles, something like that. I'll have to Google that. Well, you can Google it. Okay. Does it matter? No, it doesn't matter. So let's not do that. So anyway, 37 kilometers. And it was really hard because you're using old bikes. We were able to... Somebody actually lent us the bikes, the four bikes. I reached out to somebody. I just made a post, actually, on one of the Facebook groups to do with it. The race is called L'Eroica, by the way. That's small L, apostrophe capital E, Eroica. Like, I think there's an opera called Eroica as well. But anyway, so I reached out on one of the groups sort of saying, hey, we're coming over from Ireland. Where could we rent some vintage bikes? And this guy in northern Italy who had a bike shop said, oh, I love old bikes and I've got loads of old bikes in my shop. I'll lend you four bikes for the race. And we were like, really? You don't need money? No. Like, it was such a beautiful spirit of camaraderie. Yeah, so he showed up on the day and lent us the four bikes. So I don't know if you know about cycling, but like getting on a bike to ride in a race. I mean, they call it a race, but it's not really about who wins or who doesn't win. It's just about participation, really, and just the spirit of it. So yeah, to get on a bike and try and cycle 37 kilometers over extremely hilly terrain on crazy gravel roads because one of the reasons that the roads are remained gravel is because you'd never get a car up them. They're so steep. So, you know, going up them is really hard and then coming down them is terrifying. And good on my wife Maggie, because I've had all that experience of cycling, you know, for years. So it pretty much for me was just like riding a bike again. I remembered it all, but she didn't have any of that experience. And I think there was about 1,000 people let off in our group. So for her, it was like being in the middle of the Tour de France or something, because you have all these, it's predominantly Italians in the race. They keep it down. They keep the number of non-Italians quite limited. So I think it's less than a quarter of the total participants in the race. I think that in total they get about 5,000, something like that. But because of the different routes, like the longest route, I think, is 207 kilometers, and they set off in the dark in the morning. You know, it's held on the first Sunday of every October, so it's kind of getting into that time in the where the mornings are darker here in the Northern Hemisphere. So yeah, like they set off, you know, in the dark, and it's very atmospheric for those guys as well, because they've all got their head torches on, which is a little bit modern, but they light the Strada Biancas with them. They're like they're not candles. They're like they put them on the ground. It's like a candle in a plate, a metal plate, to light the way. I've never seen them anywhere else, but yeah, very atmospheric. And yeah, so 207 kilometers up and down those roads, that's mad. But yeah, so we did our 37 kilometers and everybody was destroyed by the time we came back. They were just wrecked because, as I say, they're very steep and it's so demoralizing. You know, you'd be struggling up this hill and then this old dude, like in his 90s, it looked like even his 90s, would just speed past you up this hill on what looked like a postman's bike, you know, no gears. And I don't know where these guys came from, but it got passed by so many people like that. But yeah, fantastic experience. Really fantastic experience. And then the following year, I think it was the following year, the year after, I went back myself, just myself and Maggie. And Maggie wasn't up for doing it again this year, that year. But I did, and I did the longer route, and that was pretty hard as well. But it's such a great experience because the day before the race is on, they have a festival kind of thing where they have all these markets, like a market for all this vintage bike stuff. And it's just the whole town is given over to this race, and everything is kind of vintage and cycling, and it's fantastic. So when I went back for that second year, through one thing and another, I got back in touch with Niall, right, the guy who had bought my bike, but it wasn't for that, it was for something else. It was for another friend who had kind of brought us together. And I was telling Niall about this, you know, the race and the vintage bikes and whatever. And he said, you know, I still have your bike. And I said, really? He said, yeah, I still have it. And he had taken great care of it. And I was like, oh, can I buy it back, please? Because I would love to go and do Leroica on my bike. And he said, yeah, that's grand. So he sold it back to me. And he had kept it in great condition. It had changed color. He had had it dipped and resprayed and all that kind of thing. But it doesn't matter. It was still my bike. It was still the bike I'd put together. And I'd say about 80% of the components that I'd had lying on my bedroom floor, you know, were still part of it. So it was really special for me to go back and do it the second time, the longer route on the bike I had put together when I was 15 or 16, which I still have. And, you know, because it was back then, it met the criteria, no problem. yeah, so that was really lovely. But anyway, recently, when my body was saying to me, come on, we've got to get the heart rate up a bit now, and going for the long walks and playing golf is great, but you need to do a bit more, need to move a bit more. So yeah, I've two bikes. I've got one that I got kind of go to town on, and I mean, I'm sure I look ridiculous, but I don't care, because I got one of those whippy flags, you know, like kids have on their bicycles, on their like small bikes. I got an adult size version of one of them, because I reckon, I know when I'm driving, if I come up on a cyclist and I'm going to overtake them, like if there's some kind of moving, some moving object or something that looks a bit strange about them, I'll give them a wider berth. So that's what I was trying to do with my little whippy flag. So I've got like lights on my helmet that are, I don't know, it looks like I'm delivering an oversized building. So all my helmet's flashing and my lights are, and my flag is waving around. And yeah, I got Maggie to go behind me just to tell me what it looked like. She said, yeah, it's pretty terrifying. So they give me a good berth. And then I have my vintage bike as well, which I've been going out on as well. And it's fantastic. It's very sore, I must say. it's taken me a while to get back in the saddle, as it were. But yeah, it's really delightful. It's a delightful thing to do. And yeah, it's great. I think when you are an artist, or, you know, you've got a sedentary, not sedentary, but stationary kind of occupation, it's just great to be able to move a little bit more than you would normally. So it's beautiful. I read a very good book. And when I say read, I mean listened to a very good book, which I want to recommend to you. It's called Humankind, and it's by Rutger Bregman. And it's big. It's a thick old book. My wife got it first in paperback, and I read a couple of pages of it. Oh yeah, I think I like this. So I got it on the audiobook, because, you know, I'm a very busy and important person. I don't have time to actually read books. So I listened to it, and it's fantastic. I mean, particularly now, strongly recommend you get it, because it's just so encouraging. I mean, I think let me just check. The byline is A Hopeful History. And yeah, it's Rutger Bregman. But yeah, he goes right into this thing of, now, you know, I don't want to get all heavy on you, but he goes right into this question that's very, you know, up in our faces at the moment of, are people fundamentally good, or are they fundamentally bad, and we just have, you know, kind of contained all that badness with civilization, which is apparently called veneer theory, that, you know, we just have this thin crust of civilization keeping us from total chaos. And he, I mean, my heart tells me, no, people are good. Everybody is good. Most people are good. In fact, the vast majority of people are good. But, you know, the news, which I don't look at that much, paints a different picture. And so he kind of goes through it scientifically and kind of breaks down where that idea came from and where we were historically and how we were back when we were supposedly savages in chaos killing each other. Apparently we weren't. We were all jolly nice to each other. He has all these cute names for, the progression of Homo sapiens. And one of them is Homo puppy, because he was kind of saying we're kind of like puppies, cute little puppies. It's a very uplifting read. And he goes right into everything, like any kind of thing you could think of, like what about this, what about war, what about the Holocaust, what about all these terrible things that we've done. And he kind of goes right into it, and I found it very good, because he's not afraid to be wrong about his assertion. So he kind of starts off going, I had this idea that people were fundamentally good, and I went on a journey to try and find out if that was actually true or not. And he was very even-handed in his handling of that. So, yeah, it's a lovely, very genuinely warming read. I found it very genuinely warming read, and it is hopeful. So, yeah. Definitely Humankind, strongly recommend it to have a read of. Speaking of how lovely people are, I've been, my further emergence work, that has been ramping up and getting bigger all the time. And lots of great feedback from people, encouraging from people. And lovely feedback in terms of really like what you're doing and great and fantastic, and the Zoom groups are growing and getting some very good questions. And then, but I'm also getting very not disturbing, but I'm kind of saddened by some of the things that people are asking me about, because it's just, I mean, I'm just me living my life in this, pretty much paradise, and very happy. Hearing directly from people who are really suffering with everything that's going on at the moment, and just mentally, like, and spiritually, I suppose, what's going on. And being able to, I've started making a lot of memes, mainly because I didn't want to fill my, I did this meditation every day, right? 15 minute meditation. That's hard to say. I do that every day, which goes directly to Instagram TV, which makes my feed look like it's just the John Dalton show, which is not what it's about. I mean, I want to make them available for sure, the meditations, because there's a certain number of people who show up for the live and do the meditation with me, but then a lot more people get in touch going, oh, I love doing those meditations with you. And I'm like kind of looking at their name going, I don't remember seeing you there at the live one. And they're like, oh no, I just do it later, which is of course makes sense, because I'm doing it at between 5:30 and 6:30, depends on how the day's gone, Irish time, which doesn't suit everybody. So a lot of people are watching the videos afterwards, which is great. But I, looking at my feed going, no, this just looks like Celebrity Squares or something with the John, it's all John Dalton. I started doing memes. I was reluctant to do memes because I came across, seen a lot of memes of like, live your passion, and it's just so kind of twee and not helpful, really. They're just too saccharine for me. I mean, just for me anyway. So I was kind of like, oh, I don't want to add to that. But then people are getting in touch saying, how concerned they were about things like the monotony of the day and and being worried about their health and loneliness and, you know, pretty intense kind of feelings. So I started doing memes. I'm doing them with my daughter, actually. She does the graphic side of things. I just write them and, you know, we back and forth, which is lovely, of course, to be working together. So, right, the reason I'm going on about all this is have a look at it. Have a look at my, at the Further Emergence Instagram. Or I'm on Facebook as well. There's a page for it as well. It's easy to find. Further Emergence. It's not a common phrase. And yeah, follow it if you like it. And then if you like any of the memes, can you share them? Can you like put them out? Because the feedback I'm getting is that they're helpful. And that's really the whole point of the whole Further Emergence thing is it's a difficult time. The whole world's going through this huge growth spurt, as I'm calling it, with all the attendant growth pains associated. And my motivation for doing the Further Emergence work and for sort of wrapping it up in this kind of Further Emergence wrapper and packaging it and making it digestible is to sort of help in some way, to sort of help with everything that's going on. So yeah, have a look at it, have a look at the memes or the meditations or whatever. And if you think if you find it helpful and if you think, yeah, that would be helpful, then please reshare it. I'm kind of on a drive at the moment to just get the word out because the feedback is, yeah, that's great. So if it's great for 10 people, it'll be great for 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 or as many as possible. So there's lots of different things you can share. There's videos on the Further Emergence YouTube channel. I mean, if you go to the web, my website, the Further Emergence website, there's links to all that. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. There's many different, you know, I'm trying to cast as wide a net to reach as many possible the people as possible. So yeah, have a look at it. If it resonates with you, I'd be really grateful if you would share it. Share bits of it, share it all, whatever. It all helps. So the audiobook is coming along nicely when I get to it. I think I told you, like, it's funny. It's like 3 weeks since we had our last, is it 3 weeks? I'm not sure. It's three episodes anyway. It's probably longer than 3 weeks. I'm not sure. Anyway, it's a while since we did the last catch up. And at the last catch up, I think I was saying I'm sorting out technical difficulties. Well, still sorting out technical difficulties. But I think I've got them all sorted out now with my lovely guy in Spain, my audio engineer. So yeah, I think we're ready to pretty much go. It's really quite hard to record an audiobook. I really feel for the people who do it. I know with me, my voice, either my voice or my brain just gives out after about 20 minutes. So I kind of have to have everything set up. Then I read about 20 minutes and then I start, you know, the wheels start falling off. I find myself repeating the same sentence like five times. So then I have to stop, go away, give my voice a little rest and then come back and then do some more. And then, you know, edit that all together. So yeah, it's coming. A lot of people are like, when is that audiobook going to be available? It's coming. Okay. It's just coming. So quite a few of you loved all the music in the last catch up. So I'm just going to play a little bit of music, this one, not a huge amount. And really, the only one I'm going to play for you is, again, what Spotify threw up. Okay. I don't know about you, but I like... I like lots of different musics. I have a very eclectic music taste, but one kind of music that really tickles my fancy is if it's a foreign language and they're singing in a different genre. Like I don't know if you've ever heard any rap that's in Arabic, like rap music but Arabic. That's very interesting to me. So this isn't that. I'm not going to play a bit of that. But this song came up and it's in German. And it's very, something about it is very cute. Now, it's sort of one of those songs that kind of gets into my head. And, you know, if I hear it, I'll be sort of humming it and smiling away to myself. And it's quite remarkable because maybe it's the music that kind of made me think, oh, this is a happy song. There's something happy going on in this song. I don't think he's singing about, you know, how he hates his life and he wants to, you know, just destroy everything. It didn't have that feel to it. It just like that guy's singing about something happy. So I looked up the chorus and he is singing. So I'll tell you what the chorus is. He's saying, I love people. They're good to me. And then I have some German neighbors and I played it for them because the song really reminds me of the husband and this, my German neighbors. I said, I think this is your theme song, Jens, which he was delighted for. And yeah, they corroborated. It's very simple. It's just happy. And it's about, I love people, they're good to me. And he kind of goes into all the different people. And there is a bit of beer drinking involved and might be a bit of football, not sure. But anyway, it's a lovely song and very catchy. So here it is. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Die Kellnerin das Bier hinstellt, die Stimmung ist gleich aufgehellt. Ich mag Leute.
You like that? I do. I'm going to be singing that now all day. I will put a link to the who that is in the show notes if you want to go to Spotify and get it.
Okay, so as I was listening to that, it dawned on me why I like music with foreign language to it. And it's because I've grown up with the Eurovision Song Contest. Now, if you don't know what the Eurovision Song Contest is, it's a contest that's been going for over 60 years in Europe. Started off with just, you know, very European countries. Now it's grown into this huge thing. It includes, you know, loads of countries across the Russian, Russia, the Eastern Europe, Baltic states. It's a huge, huge thing. But I've kind of grown up with catchy pop songs that just happen to be sung in a foreign language. And I think that's probably why I like that song. And that led me to think of and to recommend to you the movie Eurovision. It's got Will Ferrell in it and Amy Adams. Amy Adams, I think is her name. And yeah, it's a very cute movie. And now, I don't know, if you haven't grown up with Eurovision, there's a lot of really funny jokes in there. Don't know whether you're going to get them or not. It's streaming on Netflix, I think. And if you're looking for it, if you're searching for it, it's Eurovision Song Contest, The Story of Fire Saga. That's the name of their band. And yeah, it's very cute and full of very catchy songs. Songs like Ya Ya Ding Dong. Ya Ya Ding Dong. Volcano Man. Volcano Man. Kick up my melting heart. Volcanic Protector Man. Time is here, the boss loves to. Volcano Man. Volcano Man. Boarding the line. Volcanic Protector Man. The Lion of Love. Let's get together. I'm a lion lover and I hunt for love. On the savannah, I will make you rise up to the sky above. And when I roar, you know I'm done. Somewhere, someone tonight will meet the lion. My personal favorite, Double Trouble. And listen out for Will Ferrell. He's actually singing these on this song. He sang on the other one as well, the Yeah Yeah Ding Dong one. So yeah, Double Trouble. Listen out for Will Ferrell. He's actually got a really nice voice. Hey baby, when you look at me, I know I'm in double trouble tonight. Hey baby, when you talk to me, something so wrong feels so right. Come on, up, the light is down. I'm in double trouble tonight. yeah, if you like Will Ferrell, you'll like this because he's just, it's just, it's almost like it was made for him. So yeah, highly recommend that. Very, yes, it's a feel-good movie and it's got catchy songs. I mean, what more could you ask for? Okay, the last thing I want to play for you, it's not a song, don't worry. it's just in response to the what I was sent into the Zoom group. So it is a little bit from the last Zoom group where this as youngish person sent me in this questions about what they're dealing with. And yeah, it just seems so current to what's going on at the moment that I thought it would be it might be of help to include it here. So it's a little bit from the last Zoom group. Here it is. So this came in from a youngish person, like, you know, I'd say, they didn't tell me how young they were, but, you know, I'd say they're in their 20s. And they were just saying that these are the sort of things that they were thinking about, that them and their friends were thinking about and talking about. And, you know, what did I think or what did I have to say about them? And I was kind of shocked because there's like a little window into things that I hadn't really considered because they don't go on for me, which is understandable. So the first thing they were saying was that was an issue for them was rejection and fear of missing out. And that even though nobody is anywhere doing anything or having parties or anything like that, the feeling or the fear of missing out is even more intense. So if they're on social media and they see somebody who looks like they're having even a slightly good time, the feeling of being excluded from that, particularly if it's in their circle of friends, and the amount of interpretation they read into it, like, oh, there's a big party going on there and I wasn't invited, is intense. It's more intense now. And that it's a real struggle for them to take action or go to conclusions that are helpful rather than going to conclusions that are really unhelpful for them. So it's in that situation, it's like, oh, there's a party on and I'm not invited. Okay. Which, you know, when you sit back from it, it's like, well, that is crazy. Like, we're all in lockdown, so there's no party going on. whatever way you interpret that picture, you can be sure that there is not a party going on because you just can't, like, you know, no one is in anyone's space. But I thought it was very sad to you know, that it's that excruciating, because it's kind of like what I was saying earlier on about something coming to consciousness. Because, you know, pre-lockdown, you could say that fear of missing out, or FOMO, as it's called on social media, was a thing. Yeah, there were big parties going on. There were people, you know, who were able to take great pictures and, you know, in the middle of dancing, and they looked brilliant, you know. And there was a sense of like, yeah, maybe that stuff on Instagram is real. Maybe those pictures, you know, whenever I take a picture, I look terrible. But when, it, you know, other people seem to have it figured out and they're having a great time. But now that's all gone. There's no big parties going on. There's now nothing going on, really. And like that thing of fear of missing out, like when you take, it's like when you start to deconstruct it, like missing out, like you can't be missing out on anything because there's nothing going on. It's just lots of other people, your friends, they're in their houses doing pretty much exactly what you're doing. And they're just as afraid as you. So, you know, the only thing that's real in that fear of missing out is the fear, and everyone's feeling it. So you're not even missing out on that. You're all in the same kind of collective fear. But like it's a chance to look at feelings of rejection, which are awful. I mean, who wants to look at feelings of rejection? It's an awful feeling. But it's highlighted now, because logically you can kind of go, oh yeah, I'm looking at that picture and I'm feeling FOMO and I'm feeling rejected. And logically I know that there's very little chance. There's very little solid reason for me to feel like that, because whatever is being triggered by me looking at that photo is making me think that there is a party or some sort of social gathering. Maybe it's just two people, and I'll, you know, maybe there's just one person who's gone over to that other person's house for a drink. And why wasn't that person me? And why am I having that fun drink with that other person? Okay, that probably is all incorrect. Like, if ever there was a time to really be able to face how much that is being generated from inside you, now is the time. You know, because when's the next, like, when is there going to be another lockdown? Well, there might be another lockdown, but you know what I mean? Like, in time, in your life, you know, how crazy is this where we're all locked down? So you're what an opportunity this is to really look at how my mind is projecting onto things, because you kind of know that it's probably, you know, the chances of that happening, the chances of there being a party of two people or even three people that you are not invited to are so slim compared to what the chances were before the lockdown. Before the lockdown, as I said, there were parties, right? So your mind had a bit of, you know, evidence that it could, you know, use to sort of make you feel terrible. Now, no. Now there's nothing. All you know for definite is that you've got fear, and that horrible fear of rejection and fear that you're missing out. But you can bring your kind of consciousness to that and go, no, I know I'm not missing out, because the only thing that we're all experiencing is fear, and no one's missing out on that. So, you know, it is a great opportunity. It's a very hard thing to do, I know. I'm not trivializing how hard it is. But it's almost like, it is almost like being in a retreat where you get a chance to look at things in isolation. And the thing in isolation for this is fear of missing out. And the great thing is that, you know, that you've got so much evidence now that you can bring to it of like, no, I'm probably not missing out. So all I've just got is the fear. All I've got is this horrible feeling inside. And really, I'm sitting here at home. The only thing I've got any control over is how I feel. And if I, you know, if I'm feeling this kind of horrible feeling of rejection, and it's not real, you're so close then to tipping over into, yeah, if it's not real, I don't have to feel it. Okay. I'm not saying you force yourself not to feel something, but one of the beautiful things about consciousness is that it is transformative. So if you become conscious that feeling of missing out isn't actually real, because it's not based in anything. There's no party going on. You're not actually missing out. All you're doing is being at home feeling this horrible feeling. So when you become conscious of that, that transforms it. It's not like you have to talk yourself out of it. It's not like you have to force yourself to feel happy or anything like that. But just kind of becoming conscious of, yeah, there's no party going on. It's just this feeling. And this feeling is just being generated out of nothing. That, becoming conscious of that, it starts to just dissolve it. Okay. I think I told the story about the lady with the diamond ring. I'll tell it again very quickly. And this relates to consciousness, right? The effect that consciousness has. So this lady has a diamond ring. She bought it for $10,000, euros, pounds, whatever. Loves the diamond ring. She's wanted one for a long time and she loves it. Okay. So if you were talking to her, she would get it into the conversation. Your hand would kind of creep up to her face and she'd be like, you know, making sure that everybody saw her diamond ring. She would look at it and she just loved it. She'd talk about it. She'd tell you how much she paid for it if she got a chance. And she really loved it. So a year after she bought it, she decided that she should go and get it valued for insurance purposes. She brought it to the valuer and he said, I hate to tell you this, but it's a fake. It's only worth $100, euros, whatever, pounds. So she didn't fly into a rage and throw it away. She was like, oh, shit. Okay, fine. So what happened was, over the next, you know, couple of weeks and months, she certainly stopped bringing it into conversation. You know, she wasn't doing any of this up to her face anymore. She didn't talk about it anymore. And then she started to take it off when she was washing her hands, and she'd leave it on the sink. And it just, it's not like she lost it, but it just wasn't around anymore. So it was either in a box at the back of a cupboard, or it was down the back of the couch or whatever. But she just, she didn't care. So that is how it works with consciousness in my experience. And it's very powerful. So the moment of consciousness is when she went to the valuer's office and he said, it's a fake. Then she realized that what she had thought was this much value was actually only this much value. You know, what she thought was a huge value was only tiny. And that's what happens. So you're sitting at home, you're looking at your phone, you go, you just suddenly feel your stomach drop and you're like, oh shit, they're having a much better time than me. Okay. And all the feelings of FOMO and rejection, and, you know, having a better time than me, and why didn't I get invited, comes up. Then you can kind of go, well, hang on a second. Everyone's in lockdown. I am probably misinterpreting this photo. That's probably not what's happening here at all. Bear in mind, this is social media, okay? So some people are very good at social media, but, you know, just as a general rule of thumb, you can say that every image on social media is not true. It's a fiction. It's a beautifully crafted fiction, you know? It's not like you look at movies and go, why haven't I in that car with James Bond? Or why haven't I James Bond? You know, you never, you wouldn't think, you wouldn't get upset about it anyway. Not like this. So you're looking at the picture and you're going, okay, that's probably not what I think it is. So all that's real here, right in this moment, is this horrible feeling. That's the only thing that's real. And I don't, it's not based on anything. It's just misinterpretation. It's just coming up. It's something to face. It's just something I have inside me. That's the moment of consciousness, right? The way you kind of go, this is not real. And I've got a huge amount of, I've put a huge amount of value on this, that I want to be liked and included, and I want to be over there where things are better, always. Things here are not so great. Over there looks much better. I want to be over there. Okay. And you just spend, you can spend your life continually chasing over there. But when you bring it, when you become conscious of something, when you go, this is probably not what's real. I'm looking at this picture, feeling this way. The only thing that's real here is what I'm feeling. And I have, that's what I have power over. And the power is my consciousness. I'm bringing my consciousness to bear on that, that, that the only thing that's real here is this feeling. And this feeling is coming because I have placed this huge value on this idea that over there is better than here. When over there isn't. I know over there isn't better than here because everybody is in their house at the moment. No one is actually doing things. This is just a photo that makes me feel like this. And this is a chance to just sit with this feeling. And just being conscious of it will be like that lady realizing that her diamond ring wasn't that valuable. And over time, she will just lose value for her. Right. So that's... that's FOMO. So they're saying loneliness as well is another thing. Loneliness is and you know, trying to avoid the feeling of loneliness. And again, loneliness is, you know, again, like hearing these things is really, I found it very sad and hard, and my, you know, kind of heart goes out to them. Because loneliness is a very difficult thing to deal with. It's a very, it requires a lot of consciousness because, again, you kind of have to come into what's real. And what's real is, you know, you didn't know you were lonely until you met people. I know that sounds ridiculous, but when you were in the womb, you didn't know about loneliness. You know, when you got into deep, dreamless sleep, you didn't know about, you don't know about loneliness. You know, if you knew about loneliness, no one would go to sleep, like, we think about it, because even if you're sleeping beside somebody, that's lovely. You maybe, you know, your arms are touching or whatever, or your toes are touching off each other. That's lovely. But as you drop into sleep, that all stops because you come out of your senses, right? And when you're having dreams, there are other people in the dreams, and okay, not so lonely in this dream. But then eventually you just drop out the bottom of the dreams into deep dreamless sleep. Now, unless there's some party happening every night that I go to that I don't remember, and that's a possibility, but chances are, like, that is the, chances are it's not, and it's wherever I go, it's like the ultimate in loneliness, because I go into that deep dreamless place on my own. And, you know, where I came to from before I came into being, I was on my own. And even if I'm, you know, have a Hollywood kind of death where everyone is around me who loves me and they're all crying, and I'm like, oh, bye-bye, and bye-bye. You know, even if I have that, I'm still going to die on my own. I'm still going to, the process is going to be, you know, well, here I go, you know, into forever, into the mystery. And but that is, you know, from a very, and you come right back from it kind of feeling. Perspective. But up close, the feelings of loneliness can be excruciating. But that thing that we did at the beginning, that meditation that I did at the beginning, where you can reach out, there are always people out of existence. So really, when you, in one way, you can feel quite alone, but then out of existence, you're never alone. There's always people back there. Always. I say people. I mean, I say people because, well, I'm just used to people. I don't know if they're people, but it's a sense of connection and community behind the scenes is always there. And another thing I have found very helpful with loneliness is nature. That if you, you know, can get out into a bit of nature, you can get a sort of, it's not a conversation in the same kind of conversation that you would have. It's more of a communication. Whether you talk, I mean, I'm a human being, so I talk. So I might talk to the trees or the plants or the, you know, thing, because that's kind of what I do. It's easier. Sometimes it comes out of my mouth. The words come out of my mouth. Sometimes it's just in my head. And there is a communication back. It's not in words. It's in presence, I think. It's just something comes back from nature, whether it's a dog or a tree or a bit of ray of sunshine. It's just something. You just turn around. That's the thing about nature, is it's pretty complicated. So there's always something, you know, for my eye to look at in the short distance and in the distance. And this, you know, if you're looking for it, you'll see the communication and you'll feel the communication, whether it's just the shape of a branch or the way a bird flies or something like that. I find that is very helpful as well with loneliness. But sometimes the only thing that I can do with loneliness is walk through it. Sometimes loneliness can just be a desert that you just walk, that I just walk through. And just knowing that the great thing about life is that everything passes. Now, when everything is great, I don't really want to think about that too much because I'm human and I want all the good things to last. But it's really helpful when things are not going well and I'm going through difficult stuff. So when I'm going through loneliness and feeling it very keenly, knowing that everything passes helps me put one foot in front of the other. Just take the next step, take the next step. It's a little bit like what I was saying with depression. Yeah, I'm just breathing and taking the next step, not thinking about the step after it, just take the next step, just taking the next step, and knowing that things pass, mean, you know, gets me to the point where they have passed. And then I kind of look back and go, oh, that was loneliness, you know. And from experience, the more I face things, the more I face things like loneliness, the less difficult they are. It's, you know, it's that thing of, understandably, we think that physical pain and emotional pain are the same. They you know, we deal with them in the same way. So if I put my hand in the fire, I will just pull it away automatically. I don't even have to think about it. It's a reflex. If I put my hand in the emotional fire, it's understandable that the thing to do is to pull away. But unfortunately, in emotional pain works completely different to physical pain. So if I pull my hand away metaphorically from emotional pain, it comes after me. The pain doesn't just stay there. It comes. And the more I pull away from it, the more it comes. It's awful, but that's the way it works. The only way I've learned to deal with emotional pain is to stand and face it and go through it, which sounds crazy because, you know, can I have a drink, please, and some sex and some cake, you know, so I don't have to face that. But it doesn't work, you know, because when you finish the drink, the sex and the cake, it's still there. The pain is just still there waiting for you, you know, maybe more intensely. That's my experience. So the only thing is to do that I have discovered that works is the completely counterintuitive thing of when I feel pain is to turn around into it, face it, not in a masochistic way, but just in a practical way. That's the only way I've seen to get through it and to walk through it as best I can. You know, sometimes it's overwhelming. And if it is overwhelming, that's a chance to just stop, sit down, wait for it, the overwhelming bit to stop. And then, you know, as soon as it stopped, get up and keep walking through it until I've gone through it, you know. I wish there was a simpler way or an easier way to do it. Maybe there is. I haven't come across it, though. They were also saying that, talking about health and paranoia about their health, and that there's an intense focus among them on eating and exercising to gain some kind of control over the ever-changing world. Again, I talked about certainty. The time of certainty is over, and the time of the illusion of control is over. That's another one of the things that everybody, unfortunately, is having to deal with right now. Ultimately, it's a good thing because you'll come into a deeper experience of reality, which is that you don't have any control, unfortunately. No, nothing is certain. And that it's easy enough to say that, but it's very hard to live it and live with it, that everything could change, that things we thought were one way are not that way, and that they're changing very fast. And really, the only thing I know to do with that, and you know, this comes from not the current thing, not the current situation. I've been doing this for years. I've been with that knowledge for years, that nothing is certain and that I have no control, really. I have certain things that I can control, my inner state. I have sovereignty over my inner state. But sometimes even that I have no control over, because if I just suddenly, you know, go through, something comes up that's just overwhelming, you know, the only thing I can do is sit down and wait for the overwhelm to stop. But even that is me exerting a certain amount of control over my inner state, you know. But externally, no control, and there's no certainty. So I've been with that for years, and I've kind of, you know, the only way I have found to live with that knowledge is to be surrendered to it. Now, I think that's easy for me because I have a sense of what I'm surrendering to. If I didn't have that, I think I would find it much harder. And I've, you know, like, I was raised as a Catholic. So the whole idea of God was kind of rammed down my throat, and it was all scary, and God was terrible. And I can remember my grandmother, it was like, she was old school Bible thumping kind of, and she had a very, God was a scary God of retribution, you know. And I can remember, like, if I was being naughty when I was a little boy and I tripped over, my granny would say, God did that. So that's the kind of God I grew up with. But then in my teenage years, I wrote about this in May and Noise, my book May and Noise. My teenage years, I had just had a very direct experience of God, or, you know, I mean, I hate using the word God because it's so loaded, but I just, you know, I was up the side of a mountain hiking with the other, my other venture scouts that I was with, and just, I just knew something. Something was just communicated to me that night. And I've never had a, it wasn't even a question, you know. So when people talk about, you know, do you believe in God? I find that very strange kind of question, because it's like, no, I don't believe in God. I know God, you know, I have direct knowledge of God. What do I need to believe in? You know, I don't believe in anything. I either know it or I don't, you know. But so for me, it's, and like, I'm using that word God, but it's, you know, it's not like old man God up in heaven sitting with a big white beard or anything like that. It's just this huge mysterious thing that, you know, is way beyond my comprehension, and yet it's part of me and I'm part of it, and I love it and it loves me. And, you know, I've been in this kind of dialogue with it, you know, my whole life. You know, and it's like what I was saying about talking to nature. It's not like God talks back to me. I might talk in words, because that's, I'm a human, but there is communication that comes back. So for me, the idea of surrender is surrendering to that, because there is a big movement to that thing, that big, beautiful thing. There is a movement to it. And I've sort of spent my life trying to be with that movement and to not get in the way and to try and be part of the movement, you know. So that, for me, surrender is part of, it's almost like a dance, you know, like surrendering to the music of that big movement. So I can kind of go, well, I have a very limited perspective on things, you know, like even now I can look back on when I was much younger and go, God, if I, you know, that would have blown my mind back then. What I know now would have blown my mind back then. So I can even just see in my own short life how my consciousness has kind of grown. And I kind of go, yeah, so there's a big other thing out there happening that I just can't get my head around. I just, you know. So from my perspective, it looks like nothing is certain and everything is changing and I've no control. But I know that that's just because I have a really limited perspective. So knowing that, I can kind of go, okay, well, I'm just going to surrender to the mystery. I just kind of call it the mystery. Like, I just surrender to that and try my very best to listen to what the music is and try and be with it as much as possible. Now, if I didn't have that, I think it would be very difficult. So I can't really, like, if you haven't got that, that makes, I feel a lot of compassion for you if you don't have that, because then everything is just chaos for no reason. And, you know, yes, you could get hit by a bus, or things could go, you know, in all sorts of crazy ways with COVID, and it's all a bit haphazard and meaningless. And for me, it's not meaningless. I may not know what the meaning is, but I know that it does have meaning. And, you know, I have lots of proof in my own life, but it's all very subjective. But I think that's kind of part of the deal with it, you know. So if you can cultivate a sense of surrender, if anything, you can surrender to the fact. The fact is, you don't have control. You've got control of your inner state. And the fact is that everything is changing, and everything always does change, you know. And like, one of the things that happens when things speed up like this is, you can become overwhelmed by that, and that's understandable. But then I often think about, like, if you go to a graveyard, or you think about people in history, or you look at a period drama on telly, like, depending on whether it's Vikings or you know, Downton Abbey or something like that. I often go, yeah, they're all dead now. All those people who were so worried about everything, they're all dead now. You know, it's all over for them. And, you know, I can apply that to my life and go, yeah, there's some stage that I'm going to be dead too. That sounds a bit fatalistic, but it's more like, so what have I got? Like, you know, all the things I'm really worried about, yeah, it's all going to, at some stage, it's going to be, I am just going to be in I'm going to be in a period drama, you know, like it's going to be gone. So that makes me feel quite joyous in a weird kind of way, because it sort of frees me up of like, I'm taking everything very seriously when really, yeah, I've only got now. I've only got right now. And if I'm not feeling great right now, is there anything I can do to help myself, you know, feel the joy that I know is under there? You know, I know it's inside. Yeah, so that's kind of what I do.
Okay, I hope that was helpful. And if that is helpful, do check out the Zoom groups. Come to the Zoom group or watch them on YouTube. I am getting a bit behind on getting them up on YouTube. I'm going to have to figure out how to get more streamlined with that. So, yeah, if you're there live, you'll get it live. But either way, I hope that it's of help. And, yeah, if you did find it of help, yeah, do come. And yeah, that's it for now. I hope you're well, be of good cheer, and I'll talk to you again soon.
I've never felt this good in my entire life. Make me some spaghetti.
Actually, I'd prefer a cup of tea. A cup of tea would be lovely. So yeah, just a little reminder, mainly because every second or third person who becomes a patron has got in touch with me and said, you know what, I've been listening to your podcast for ages and I didn't become a patron, not because I don't have the money, not because I don't think it's great, I just didn't get around to it. So this is a little friendly reminder that if you'd like to be a patron, you'd like to buy me a cup of tea, go to patreon.com/John Dalton, gently does it, all one word. Or follow the link in the show notes to become a patron. I would really appreciate it if you could do that, particularly if you've been meaning to and you just haven't got around to it. It would be great. It would mean a lot to me. All right. Thank you. Bye.
We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. Come on, buy us a drink. Come on, buy us a drink. We are the Argyle Pimps. So buy us a drink. We're better than you thought, but not as good as we think. We are the Argyle.